Godzilla is now in New York City.
Monster 01 and 02, commence the attack.
Okay, I'm gonna lay some ground rules for this episode. No one can talk bad about my favorite movie ever made.
Precursor, this movie's trash?
No, I'm kidding.
Immediately kicked off the podcast.
Disqualified.
Disqualified. Alright, well, we just sat down and watched the original Godzilla film from 1954.
The Japanese version, of course.
The Japanese version. I had intended to sit down and watch the American version as well by myself. I didn't get around to that.
Yeah, we don't have that kind of time here.
We don't have that kind of time around here, but I've seen it enough times. I know what it's all about.
It has white people in it, right?
It has Raymond Burr in it.
It has Raymond
specifically.
Burr.
Raymond Burr is re-edited into it as the main character, as a reporter.
I guess I'll have to watch that one sometime, but today is
Sunday.
Not that day.
Today, it's interesting. They don't totally trash it like they do some future Americanized versions. what is this? This is our 5th episode?
It doesn't really matter.
Of Stomp This Way?
We were keeping track of episodes.
We weren't really. This is the 3rd movie we are doing. So, as usual, we're going to kind of talk about the making of this movie. I've got a good little list here going. Obviously, I love this movie. This is one of my favorite movies ever made. I'm not going to commit to saying it's my favorite Godzilla movie, but it is definitely in that conversation. So, why don't we go ahead and kind of talk about the origins of this movie. So, in 1954, producer Tomoyuki Tanaka, who is kind of like the godfather of the Godzilla franchise, you know, he's the one that really piloted this thing into turning into what it is today. He had gone to Indonesia to make this movie translated into English, it would have been called In the Shadow of Glory. It was kind of like a movie kind of detailing the aftermath of the Japanese invasion of Indonesia during World War II. But at that time, the relationship with Japan and India was still really rocky. And apparently negotiations for that movie, you know, kind of fell through. So he was flying back to Japan. And as the story goes, he looked down at the ocean and imagined a giant monster coming out of it and kind of made any... making a movie out of that. I think by this point he had seen The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, but he kind of really just sat down and he wrote a rough outline of what this movie was gonna be. I think he originally called the movie like The Giant Monster from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So a little derivative there. But I think you can tell this watching it, heavily influenced by The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Also, an event that had happened right before this movie started being made was the Lucky Dragon number 5 incident. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Nope.
Where this boat, which it was called the Lucky Dragon number 5, was a fishing vessel. It kind of wandered into the fallout area of the Bikini Atoll atomic bomb tests. And they all got radiation sickness. One of them later died from it. I think some of the fish actually got like some radiation infected. And there was like this big scare in Japan about it. It was a big deal over there. So obviously, you know, this movie only came out 9 years after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nuclear fears were still really high in Japan as well as the rest of the world. So, you know, and Ishiro Honda was a war veteran. I think he had gone as part of the invasion of China or whatever, you know. So he had obviously vivid memories of the war and everything. So anyway, so this guy named Kayama was hired to write the story, the initial story. And it said that he wrote this thing in about 11 days. And it's not really, I mean, it's definitely a lot of the things that he wrote for his initial story was carried over for the script. But, you know, in his story, I think Dr. Yamane was really more of a central focus, and he was kind of like a shady character, like a mad scientist type guy. And Godzilla was more of like a hungry animal, like looking for food, than the sort of force of nature that we got in the original movie. But after he wrote that, it was given to Murata and Honda, Takeo Murata and Ishiro Honda, and they sat down in a hotel for about 3 weeks and knocked out the screenplay. Eiji Tsuburaya was brought on to do effects. Eiji Tsuburaya was, I think, kind of like president of special effects or whatever at Toho at the time. You know, I've heard it said that, like, at Toho, if, you know, Kurosawa was kind of like God at Toho, and then Tsuburaya was kind of like second behind him. So basically, anything either Kurosawa or Tsuburaya wanted, they got from Toho. So Tsuburaya was a big fan of the original King Kong and the effects, the stop motion effects that Willis O'Brien had done on that movie. He wanted to do stop motion for Godzilla, but he sat down and he calculated it out, and he went to the producers and was like, "Hey, it's going to take me 7 years to do the effects for this movie if I do this stop motion."
And they said,
They were like, "We need this thing out in 9 months." And he's like, "Okay. Well, let's rethink this a little bit." So, you know, people really kind of laugh at Suitmation, as it's called, people in rubber suits, you know, stomping on cities or whatever. And they kind of think of it as the cheap way out. But before this movie, Suitmation was not really a thing. Suitmation, the effect style of taking a guy in a suit and having him kind of destroy model cities, was not really a thing. This is really invented, or really started with this movie. And I think Tsuburaya did an incredible job of not only designing this suit and building this suit, you know, he had other people helping him build the suit and stuff, but also these models, which these miniatures are, I think we'll all agree, and we'll talk about it later, are, you know, really good.
They're pretty dang good.
So Tsuburaya's special effects crew spent 71 days filming the special effects scene of this movie. Special effects scenes of this movie. Ishiro Honda's crew spent 51 days filming the human parts of the story. And I don't think it's kind of like today, where you have a director and he's in charge of the whole entire aspect of the movie and he's keeping up with everything. Really, with this movie, Ishiro Honda, who is the credited director, but really he was in charge of the human stuff. And Tsuburaya was in charge of the monster stuff. But I think I think it works out. You know, if you watch the movie, I mean, there's not like some kind of stark contrast between the two things. But anyway, they sit down, they film this movie, and they put it together in about the span of 9 months or so. And it came out November 3rd of 1954. Some little trivia I put together. Gojira is the combination of the Japanese words for gorilla and whale.
Gorilla whale.
Gorilla whale.
Gorilla whale.
The suit weighed 220 pounds.
That poor guy.
It was a big suit. Not, it is said that Nakajima lost 20 pounds during the filming of this movie.
Probably from sweating so dang
much.
Yeah, we watched a whole like thing about the making of the suit and the production of this movie at the end of watching the movie. And something about, at the end of every filming session, they would drain a cup of sweat out of the suit. Yeah. I was like, that's disgusting.
That is horribly disgusting.
Could you imagine?
Yeah.
They also said it could get upwards of 135 degrees inside that suit.
That poor man.
It was rough. I thought this was kind of funny. I saw this on Wikipedia. They said while Tsuburaya and his crew were scouting, like, locations in Tokyo to base their model cities off of, some police officer like overheard them talking about it destroying stuff and like almost arrested them before like Tsuburaya pulled out his Toho company cards.
That's hilarious.
Also, something I found interesting, you know that scene with the girls singing after Tokyo is destroyed and everything? You know, I kind of figured that they had just taken like a few girls and you know kind of like used some mirror effects and stuff to make it look like a whole bunch of people. But no, according to Wikipedia, they actually went to an all girls school and got like 2,000 girls in an auditorium and filmed them singing this song.
I don't know. Back to the suit though. I mean, like, could you imagine this man stuck it out for what was it, close to like 30 years in the suit, 20-30 years in the suit?
I think the last movie he did was Godzilla versus Gigan, so about 20 years.
He stuck it out for 20 years in the suit. Mm. After the everything that I had been through in that first movie, I don't know that I'd want to do it again.
It does get better.
I mean, it's a trooper.
I mean, he goes through a lot of crap in a lot of these movies, but, like, the suit gets a lot lighter after this movie.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, but... So, how did this movie do in its original box office run? So, in Japan, this movie had a production... I mean, these all these numbers come from Toho Kingdom, so, you know, not my fault if they're not accurate, but I think they probably are pretty accurate. And this is all in U.S. dollars. So, production budget, it had a production budget of around $900,000.
Which is pretty impressive for 1954.
For 1954 Japan, I would say that was probably a pretty big budget for a movie. They said it had another marketing budget on top of that of about $600,000. So, let's say Toho spent about $1.5 million making this movie in total.
Not bad.
The original box office run in Japan, it grossed about $2.25 million. So pretty good profit margin. I could not find this anywhere, but I know I've read somewhere that it was the second most successful movie in Japan that year behind Seven Samurai. I mean, it was a big hit for at the time for a Japanese movie. Total attendance, I guess just number of tickets sold is said to be 9,610,000, which is something I was looking at, like, still the ninth in terms of number of tickets sold, still the 19th most successful film in Japan in Japanese history. So, I mean, really impressive. It was leased by Transworld to an American film company in 1956, or I guess they acquired it probably in 1955. It came out in 1956, but they leased it for $25,000. And it went on to make $2 million additional dollars in its initial run in America. And then they reissued it in 2004 for the 50th anniversary, and it only made like $400,000. But I think it was only released at like 3 theaters or something. But still the second most attended Japanese Godzilla film. We'll talk about which is the most attended later. But, you know, those are some really impressive box office numbers. I think, for the time, it was a big hit.
1950s. Giant monster movie. I mean, yeah, it's pretty great.
So I think here we're gonna play the trailer for you, the original trailer, and then we will come back and we will give you the plot.
ゴジラ世界中の学者誰一人として見ていない日本だけに現れた貴重な研究者だしかし先生だからといってあのキョウボウな怪物をあのまま仏陰に行きません今ではゴジラを抹殺しようというのか。バカだ素人のあなた一人を海の中に放り込みますか俺が死なない限りどんなことで再び使用する立場に追い込まれないと誰が断言できる。お前決まったね。恐ろしい目的に際立ったとした青年科学者芹沢が秘めた恐るべき発明とは。 近代兵器を装備し突如出動する一回空の精鋭ゴジラの恐怖から脱出する難民の群れ。
国際問題が一体どうなるか。制作費1億、6ヶ月を超えた国が政府の国ゴジラ映画技術の 衆を集め大東方が全能力を挙げた空前のスペクタクルゴジラ、本年最大の話題作ゴジラ。
All right, everyone, we are back. I'm going to go ahead and list off the cast and crew, and then Dylan will give you in the plot summary, and then we will get into our discussion. So this film is obviously directed by Ishiro Honda, written by Takeo Murata, Ishiro Honda, and Shigeru Kayama, starring Akira Takarada, Momoko Kochi, Akihiko Hirata, Takashi Shimura, Haruo Nakajima, Katsumi Tezuka, and if you watch the American version, Raymond Burr. Something just real quick interesting that I learned. I didn't know this, or at least I'd forgotten. There's actually two people in the film in the Godzilla suit. Haruo Nakajima is in the suit most of the time. They actually had brought on Katsumi Tezuka to also play him, but because he was older than Haruo Nakajima, he couldn't really handle a lot of the physical requirements. So he was really kind of used as like a stunt double, like when Haruo Nakajima absolutely couldn't go. Like, they would put him in the suit, and so most of his scenes in the suit didn't make it in the final cut, from what I understand, but he is in a couple of scenes. And from what I understand, he's still alive at, like, 106. Dang, I couldn't find anywhere that's old man. I couldn't find a lot on him. Like, there's not very much on him, but from what I could tell, he was still alive. So, also, very important, music by Akira Fukube. Absolutely. And effects by Eiji Tsuburaya. So, Dylan, why don't you give us the plot? As written by me.
All right. This plot summary is written by Aaron, so if it's terrible, blame him.
It's my fault.
That's actually not that bad. All right. When ships begin mysteriously disappearing or sinking off the coast of Japan, a group of journalists go to Odo Island to investigate. That night, what seems to be a typhoon strikes the island, but in the morning it appears that the house and the helicopters were crushed from above. The Japanese government sends an investigative team led by Dr. Yamane and his daughter Emiko. There they encounter Godzilla, an ancient dinosaur awakened by nuclear testing. Godzilla soon makes his way to Tokyo, and the Japanese government is powerless to stop him. Japan's only hope seems to reside in Dr. Serizawa, who's developed an oxygen destroyer, a weapon that destroys all oxygen when placed in water. Serizawa also happens to be betrothed to Dr. Yamane's daughter Emiko, but Emiko is in love with the young Coast Guard Captain Ogata. Dr. Serizawa is hesitant to reveal his weapon to the public for fear that it will be used as a weapon of war, but Emiko and Ogata convince him to use it against Godzilla. In the final scenes, Ogata and Serizawa dive to the ocean floor in order to use the weapon against Godzilla, but Serizawa stays behind and is killed along with the monster so that the secrets of the oxygen destroyer die with him.
Alright, so this movie, obviously, I mean, I'm going to talk really good about it, but I think it gets off on a really good start. You know, we have this opening scene on this boat where I think it's a direct reference to the Lucky Dragon number 5 incident where these people are on this boat. And they see a blinding flash of light, and then the boat kind of catches on fire, and you see it sinking, and you had, like, the guys on the telegram in the ship, and before the water, like, floods in on them, and they presumably, I think, all of them die. But, so, you know, they start off with a very powerful imagery, and, you know, just really hitting hard that theme already of, you know, really what this movie is going to be, and then we learn that later that, you know, more ships are sinking because they'll send more ships to go investigate it, and then they'll sink too and everything. But
we later find out like 17 ships.
17? Yeah, I wrote that. That's like 17 ships. That's like, I think you'd stop like going through that channel of water after a while. But I don't know. Like, I was watching it this time. I mean, I know you haven't watched Shin Godzilla.
No.
But, I was actually kind of reminded of Shin Godzilla. I'd forgotten how much of the beginning of this movie was really people in kind of boardrooms and stuff talking about the ship sinking, you know, what are we going to do and stuff. But were you grabbed by this opening, or were you just kind of like, what?
Well, I was kind of like, what is happening?
I mean, and you've seen it a lot of times with me, but
this is the second time I've seen
it. The first time I saw it, I was like that.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I like the opening. I think, you know, it's not quite the opening. I guess if you've been just, you know, your average American audience member walking into this movie, never had any experience with Godzilla whatsoever, because this is actually I had seen bits and pieces of the 2014 Godzilla, but this is the first Godzilla movie I think I watched all the way through for the first time, which I guess is good on me watching the original first. Thank you, Aaron. But watching this, I mean, I guess coming from an outside standpoint, it's not maybe the opening you would expect from something titled Godzilla about a giant monster, but I think it really works for this movie. I mean, it really sets up, like you said, it sets up that tone for this movie about what it's going to be, so
yeah,
I like it.
The American version actually starts a little more, like, American-y, I guess.
American?
Has a monologue by Raymond Burr. Freaking monologue. And it, like, pans across, like, it's the shot you see later in the movie of, like, Tokyo destroyed, and then it shows, like, Raymond Burr buried under some debris, and then he's like, I forget exactly what he says, but he's like, the story of a monster destroying Tokyo or whatever, and then it cuts, like, back to him, like, at the beginning. You know, you see that a lot where it starts at like at the middle or the end, and then they cut back to the beginning and tell the whole story or whatever. But I do like this ending. This beginning, I think it's really interesting. But after this beginning, I mean, this movie is kind of slow in plotting, and yeah. I'm not saying that is a knock really, but it's just the type of movie that it is. A lot
if
of
if you
Japanese
wanted to
films,
equate it to something, I guess like something kind of similar. I mean, I wouldn't say it's similar necessarily because it's a completely different genre of movie, yeah. But it's like a courtroom drama. Kind of. You're just sitting and people are talking and there's a lot of exposition and things going on before anything of great, you know, interesting or action-y things happen, so.
I mean, if you've seen a lot of Kurosawa films, they're like this too, where there's a lot of, I mean, they're really kind of, and that's kind of the style of Japanese cinema, that they're just kind of slow and plotting and then you'll have action scenes, you know, interspaced without that.
Got a lot of dialogue and a lot of exposition.
Not definitely not them. Like these hyperactive blockbusters, Hollywood blockbusters we watched today, but I mean, I enjoy, especially, you know, the older this movie, the time this movie is set in, you know, seeing how they would handle stuff like this, and seeing them use like telegrams and, you know, like these old timey radios and stuff. And we are pretty early on in this movie introduced to. There are really four main characters. There are four. There's not really a main character in this movie. There are really four main characters. And again, that's not really a knock, and that's something you'll see more in Japanese movies. I have criticized American movies for having this issue, but here, for one, it's intentional. And also, I like all four of these characters. We have Akira Takarada playing Ogata. Akira Takarada will come back many times. Momoko Kochi playing Emiko, who is Ogata's girlfriend, but she's been betrothed by her father to Dr. Sarazawa, played by Akihiko Hirata. And then, of course, Dr. Yamane, who is played by Takashi Shimura. Takashi Shimura is actually, I mean, at the time, I'm sure he was the most famous of this cast. He's pretty famous worldwide because he's in a lot of Akira Kurosawa movies. He's probably most famously the old wise samurai in Seven Samurai, like the leader of the group, and he's a really good actor, and I think he's really good here. I think all of these people are acting really good here. I think if I'm gonna knock the acting at all, I would say that I'm probably screwing her name up really good, but Momoko Kochi as Emiko, some of the times when she's crying or trying to cry is kind of sketchy, but other than that, I would say that the acting is really good.
No, the acting in this movie, I think, is actually pretty dang good.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that, you know, you didn't know, I wonder what they're, you know, when they were told, like,
okay,
you know, in
guys,
the 50s,
they walk out,
playing
like,
in,
okay,
you're playing in a monster
you're
movie.
You're going to be in a movie about a giant dinosaur. They're like, wait, what?
What? But I think probably the way, I'm sure Ishiro Honda, like, probably presented this, like, you know, this is not just a monster movie. This is an allegory for nuclear weapons, and you know, Ishiro Honda, you hear him talk about this movie, and he was like, you know, this was really important to him. He really wanted to deliver a powerful message about, you know, nuclear weapons. I think he's even quoted as saying that he said they were really naive at the time, and that some of them, like, they really believed that this movie would, like, put an end to nuclear proliferation. But, so, you know, they took it seriously, and you can tell that they're taking this seriously.
And they put a lot of hard work into it. For the limited time that they had to work on this movie, I guess 9 months, it's impressive what they were able to pull off and how good a story they were able to come up with and create. And the fact that it's so well written for how short it was written in 3 weeks.
If you told
these big budget movies nowadays,
you got 3 weeks.
Got 3 weeks to write me a script, and you got 9 months to get from pre-production to post-production and release it.
Yeah,
most of them couldn't do it.
They could not do it.
And if they did, it would turn out very poorly.
The fact that they have, you know, I would say that this movie, the human drama in this movie, and just the script is way better than what we got in King of the Monsters, right?
Leaps and bounds.
And they wrote this thing in 3 weeks.
3 weeks instead of 2.5 years.
2.5 years writing it. I'm like, that's where I'm so disappointed in King of the Monsters. Like, you just look at, I mean, and there's no, like, complicated, super complicated storylines, like, interwoven throughout this and everything. It's pretty, you know, simple storytelling.
Yeah.
But it is so much better.
It's just done well.
Done well. You know, like, I really...
Like, someone actually cared or tried?
I really like the human drama. You have this, you know, this love triangle between Ogata and Emiko and Dr. Sarazawa. And, you know, in any other monster movie from the 50s, Dr. Sarazawa would just be your generic mad scientist. But here, no, he's actually a good guy with an actual, you know, like, human story behind him. He lost his eye in the war, and, you know...
He's creating this weapon, but he really doesn't want to use
it. He has really accidentally stumbled upon this weapon, but he doesn't want to use it because he's afraid that it will be used like the nuclear bomb was.
He's got a moral compass, guys.
He's got a moral compass, and...
Like a good person.
And he sacrifices himself so that the secrets of the weapon, you know, will never be known to anyone again until Godzilla versus Destroyer of it.
He was just a nice guy. I mean, he's a really decent human being.
I really like what they did with it. I'm so glad they didn't just go the generic mad scientist route. There is no mad scientist. Even Dr. Yamane, who is like another one that could have easily have stumbled into generic mad scientist territory. He's kind of like the doctor from Beast from 20,000 Fathoms that was, you know, really interested in just studying the monster.
Yeah.
He's like that character, but just done way better. Like, he doesn't want to kill Godzilla because he... Like, I really like one of his lines where he's like, we should be focusing on how he survived this massive dose of atomic radiation.
He's kind
of
like Serizawa in the Legendary movies where he really cares about the creatures.
Yeah. The Serizawa in the Legendary movies is really Serizawa and Yamane just kind of...
Combined
into one character. Andrew, were you invested in this human plot?
I thought the human plot was... pretty good for what the movie was in there.
Did you think it was more interesting than what the humans were doing in King of the Monsters?
Totally.
Not hard. I think it's really good. I'm very impressed.
Now, with that said, is King of the Monsters a more entertaining movie?
Yes.
I would say, for me personally, no. Is it more hyperactive, ADHD, and is there more happening, and is there more action?
Yes.
The answer to all those questions is yes. But it
does that all any, that combined make for a better movie? And, absolutely.
At any point, am I more invested in King of the Monsters than I am in this movie? No.
No.
I thought this one was a better made movie, but I thought that one had like better.
I can see for a lot of people, the kind of slow plotting of this movie
would turn them off.
Because Godzilla, I mean,
if you were, you know, your typical American audience, like I said at the beginning, and you walk into this movie and you're like, okay. You've heard about Godzilla your entire life. You're like, all right, I've never seen a Godzilla movie. I don't really know anything about Godzilla. And you're like, okay, cool. It's about a giant monster. You walk in and you're like, oh, there's a lot of exposition and scenes of dialogue. There's a lot of just people sitting around talking and, you know, investigating things. Nothing's really happening. You're like, I came here to watch giant monsters destroy things. And you don't get that really until like the last part, like the last 30 to 40 minutes of the movie.
You know, a lot of people complained about the screen time for Godzilla in Gareth Edwards' Godzilla movie, and really Godzilla doesn't have any more screen time in this movie, but the differences are, one, the humans are way better written in this movie, and two, this movie, you know, is Godzilla is always the focus of the plot. You know, in Godzilla 2014, Godzilla was never really the focus. The focus was on those Mutos.
The Mutos, yeah.
But I mean, I'll talk more about that when we get to that movie eventually. But
that's like a year and a half from now.
Yeah, but I really like the way that Godzilla is kind of like always on everyone's mind and how he's like, you know, always kind of a sense of dread. But I like the scene, you know, let's go to this scene in Odo Island when...
Odo Island.
First, I like the scene when just the journalists go and it's... You know, they have, like, typhoon that hits, but the, you know, the house is, like, destroyed. And, you know, that one young kid, I forget his character's name, on the island, though, that...
Is just shouting, though?
Yeah, his brother, I guess his family gets killed. And because of how dark the scene is, you know, maybe there's something bigger moving above the house. Maybe there's not, you know, you don't really know. And then I like the scene where it kind of zooms out and you see the helicopter kind of, crushed and broken, and it kind of falls over. And it kind of builds the suspense, you know, for, you know, them to reveal Godzilla. And then when the researchers later go to the Odo Island and we have our first encounter with, real encounter with Godzilla.
Yeah.
I think it's at least in concept, it's a really impressive scene. And in execution, it's pretty good. I like the puppet they use. At times, it looks pretty good. At times, it looks kind of bad. Like, when they show the puppet rising up over the mountain from the side, I think it looks really good. When you're looking at the puppet, like, head-on, it looks a little rough. It looks
kind of smooshed.
Yeah, but I think the matting is actually really good in that scene where you see Godzilla up above the hill and then the people running down the hill. I think that's actually done really well. And I have to say, like, I love Godzilla's footsteps in this movie, even though it's just, like, a guy banging on a huge, like, bass drum. I really like his footprints, and then his roar in this movie. I love his roar in this movie. Do you know how they made his roar?
Would, like, put it as his ringtone.
Do you know how they made his roar in this movie? They took like a cello with like the back torn out of it, and they got a resin glove or whatever, and they like rubbed it slowly across the strings and then played it backwards.
Interesting.
I don't know how, like, I don't know who that sat around and thought, hey, this is how we're gonna make this roar, but. That's how they did it.
Interesting.
But anyway, I like this first scene on Odo Island with Godzilla. And then, you know, later when the first time he comes to Tokyo, I think is really well done. Is the scene where, you know, he comes in and he, like, the train's coming at him. But then, you know, his foot lands in front of the train and the train comes off the tracks and everything. And you see all the, I think because that scene is so dark, the matting effects actually look pretty good. The darkness, like, assists it because you can't really tell. That much that he's matted onto that screen behind those people. But, and Godzilla's theme is, I don't know, I guess it's not, it's a theme that will come back in more Godzilla movies. It's the bum, 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 bum. But anyway, I really like it. And it's really ominous as Godzilla, like, stomps through the city and everything. But, I don't know, I think this first scene, and then it's not too long before Godzilla, you know, he leaves for a little bit, and then he comes back for, like, the big Tokyo destruction sequence.
Yes.
And, you know, the effects in this big Tokyo destruction sequence, we'll talk about them later. They're a little hit and miss, but I really do like it, and how Godzilla, he is a force of nature, but he also has a bit of an attitude, like...
He walks up to Tokyo. He like, walks up into Tokyo, and then as soon as you see him, like, step up into, like, this, like, ship area, like, yeah. Shipyard area, he's kind of like, you can instantly tell he's, like, kind of pissy.
Mm. Yeah, I love how he doesn't just destroy, like, to get through the electrical towers, like, power lines, he doesn't just...
He walks through and they shock him, and he's like, oh, what the heck?
And then he destroys, like, three more.
And then he just uses his atomic breath and just goes, wah, and just, like, burns him to the ground.
Yeah, I love this scene as a whole. And then, you know, him going through the city and then just wrecking everything. And the clock, like, when the clock starts dinging, he gets mad at it and tears it down. And then the...
Did he destroy a castle in this one? Or does that become a thing after this?
He did kind of walk through the Diet building, you know, their Capitol building or whatever. I love the scene with the reporters, where the reporters are, like, doing their live report on the tower, and then he goes up to it and, like, bites it and rips it down. There's just a lot of stuff that I really like in this scene. And, you know, at the end of it, where the jets kind of chase him off.
Yeah, they do a really good job of making Godzilla, like, a character and not just a giant monster.
And the model, talk about effects later, but they really do a great job of, like, the scale, making him seem really massive in this scene and everything, but done really well. And then I had to say, the most powerful scene in this movie is the scene right after that in the hospital, where the imagery is really evoking stuff that you would have seen after the bombing of Hiroshima. With them waving the Geiger counter over the kids, and the kids are, you know, the Geiger counter is going crazy, and the doctor there is just kind of like shaking his head. And then, you know, the girl, you know, you see her mom presumably dead in front of her, and they carry her mom away, and she starts screaming for her mom. And Emiko goes up and grabs her, and you can see, like, the devastation on Emiko's face and everything.
I know we'll talk about score later, but you pointed out, I mean, the score in this scene right after the destruction of Tokyo it really adds to the effect that they're going
it's
for.
It's pretty depressing.
And this is where Emiko, you know, earlier in the movie, she had gone to Sarazawa's with a reporter, and Sarazawa had kind of, you know, ran the reporter off, but he had shown her his weapon, the Oxygen Destroyer. But they didn't show us what the Oxygen Destroyer did, which is something, again, I'll credit this movie for. Like, I feel like in most monster movies of the time, like, they just shown, like, oh, yeah, here's this weapon, here's what it does. But here they, like, build suspense with it. They don't show you what it does until this flashback scene, and we see how it kind of, like, disintegrates the fish in the water. I mean, if you're going by the science of the Oxygen Destroyer is a little wonky, because since it destroys all oxygen, that water should no longer be there. It should just be gas. But, you know, I'm not going to get caught up on that. You know, and she's horrified by it, but she makes him this promise, but then she breaks this promise, and she tells Ogata. If you watch the American version, it's actually, like, they have a Steve Martin after, you know, he's, you know, dug out of the rubble, and he's in this hospital. And they got, like, a stunt double actress for Emiko, and they, like, just, like, done her hair up like Emiko and showed her from behind and, like, had Raymond Burr talking to her. And he's actually the one that convinces her to go, like, break this promise and go tell Ogata. Anyway, but in the Japanese version, she tells Ogata, and they go over to Sarazawa's house, and him and Ogata kind of get into it. The scene where, again, another really moving scene. After this fight, I will say that I don't think the TV was turned on before the fight, and it somehow magically got turned on. Maybe it got turned on during their scuffle, I don't know. Like, they had the scene where they're showing, like, a montage of the people in the hospital, and then the complete destruction of Tokyo, and then they have the girl singing that song that Akira Fukube wrote or whatever. I think it's really moving, and then, of course, it moves Sarazawa to agree to use his weapon, but then he burns his notes so that no one else can have it. I think this is all, like, really moving stuff to me. But anyway, so we get to the, you know, the final scene, the death of Godzilla. Godzilla would later go on to star in 34 more films. But where, you know, they go underwater and
we get this really heartfelt moment where Sarazawa just, like, sacrifices himself.
Yeah. Ogata for him and Emiko to be happy.
He wants them to be happy together.
And it's really moving.
And you're like, he's a good guy.
And then Yamane has his speech about, if we don't stop using nuclear weapons, Godzilla may come again. Little did he know, in about 8 months, he'd be right back up there on screen. I don't know. I think this movie is really well written. It's one of the best written Godzilla movies still to date.
Probably the best written Godzilla movie to date, hands down. And I've not even seen all of them, so I'm just going to 100% say, final opinion, best written Godzilla movie.
Best written Godzilla. It definitely is up there. And
it's probably, because they, I don't know, it's impressive that considering the fact that this is the first Godzilla movie, how well they were able to incorporate a really good human storyline with Godzilla.
And, you know, the Oxygen Destroyer, you know, we laughed at the Oxygen Destroyer in King of the Monsters. But here, you know, it is a direct allegory for the nuclear bomb. And I think the way they incorporate it into this story is actually really good. And at no point do I think it's, like, laughable that they have this.
No, the fact that we laughed about it in that movie is just the fact that it shows up in this movie and the way that they act about it. It's like, we can destroy them with the Oxygen Destroyer. And you're like, wait, what? No.
I feel it was kind of a slap in the face to the creators of this movie and how they incorporate it. And it was such a serious allegory for the nuclear bomb.
And in that movie, it's just there just to try
it's
to
just destroy a reference.
It's pure reference. But
it does nothing. But
it literally doesn't do anything in the movie. It barely hurts Godzilla.
Yeah.
It puts him out of commission for like 20 minutes. 20 and it minutes. Doesn't do anything to Ghidorah.
But it's just, you know, it's... I just really love this movie so much.
It's a really good movie.
It's one of my
favorites. I will say, this is one you're not crazy on.
This is one I'm not crazy on. So
One of the few.
Now, when we get farther down the line, I'll probably be like, Aaron, you're stupid. Andrew, you're dumb.
But is there anything else as far as the plot was concerned we wanted to talk about?
I don't know. Andrew, what are your thoughts so far on the plot? Or what are your final thoughts on the plot? Like, I mean, did you think that it's done well, it's well written?
Yeah, I thought it was well written for.
Were you entertained, or are you bored?
I was not bored during most of that movie.
Most of it. Are there parts that you would say you were bored? What would those parts be?
The ones with the long dialogue. Nothing really happened.
Well, that's a lot of the movie.
It's a lot of the movie. I mean, yeah, between, I would say, you know, towards the beginning, before the Odo Island scene, there is a lot of talking and dialogue. And then between the Odo Island scene and when he first shows up in Tokyo, there is a lot of just sitting around and talking. Now, after the first scene in Tokyo, you know, they have the first Tokyo attack. And then they almost immediately, like 5 minutes later, go into the second attack on Tokyo. And then we have a little more, you know, a dialogue heavy scenes before we get into the final climax of the movie. But I think it's paced, all things considered, I think it's paced pretty well.
Yeah.
It's not paced badly.
Like, unlike when we get to Shin Godzilla, where it is literally just Godzilla shows up, like an hour of dialogue, Godzilla shows up, and then like an hour of dialogue, and then the Godzilla thing happens at the end. But
that movie's that long?
It's about 2 hours.
Oh, God.
And it's literally Godzilla at the beginning, Godzilla at the middle, Godzilla in the middle, and then Godzilla at the end.
All the rest is people just talking in a
boardrooms. It is. But
that's going to be miserable.
And some of the boardrooms.
I have mixed feelings about it, but we'll get to it when we get to it.
That's going to be miserable. But anyway, not that I have a problem with movies that are exposition heavy.
It's just kind of interesting how they just have a conference room for every... A conference room for every single thing that's happening.
Yeah, we'll talk about it when we get there. But let's move on to monster design. There's only one monster to talk about.
Thank God.
Thank Godzilla.
That's a nice play on words.
Good one. I really like Godzilla's design in this movie.
There's nothing like the classic Godzilla.
I think he looks kind of creepy, like the way he has tiny pupils in his eyes.
At some point in time, at some shots, his eyes are just completely like black.
The puppet they use, yes, the eyes are almost completely black. It does kind of transition, but I love his like kind of the way his ears are like super tiny, the kind of like dragon like head they have, and his dorsal.
It's like a kind of a rounded, smushed dragon head.
Yeah. His dorsal fins look really neat. He has three distinct rows, and the middle one's bigger than the other two, but they're kind of pointy. And then the tail, I really like his design.
He looks very reptilian.
Yeah, and then, of course, the idea of him having a heat atomic ray, really neat. His roar, I really love his roar, like I said, in this movie. His footsteps are really cool. I just kind of wish that they had been more prevalent and more consistent throughout the movie. Like, towards the beginning of the movie, almost every time Godzilla's nearby, you hear that big boom, boom. I wish that had been more at, like, every time he took a step in Tokyo, they would have kind of done that. But, you know, minor complaint. But just as far as the design itself, I really like it. Andrew, does this rank among, like, one of your better Godzilla designs?
Yeah. It's one of my top favorites, Godzilla designs.
Yeah. I don't know if I can list, like, a specific top five, but this would definitely be in my top five Godzilla designs. Of the ones you've seen, would you say it's one of the better ones?
I wouldn't say Godzilla's design transitions a huge amount out of the movies that I've seen, considering the fact that...
Yeah, it does.
Some of them, kind of. I mean, after the first couple, I think it changes minorly, but I don't think it, like, changes, like, extremely drastically.
It changes quite a bit. You haven't seen Godzilla Raised Again, but it changes quite a bit from this movie to the next one. He kind of looks like an anorexic Godzilla in the next one.
He does.
But,
I guess we'll find out. But I don't know. I like the original Godzilla design. I think he's probably one of the best. I know, based just on the tremendous amounts of figures that Aaron has in his room. I'd say probably one of the coolest ones that I've seen is maybe the Final Wars Godzilla is really cool.
Yeah, you'll have to see it in action.
Oh, Lord.
But kind of transitioning into effects. You know, the effects, you know, some of them hold up better than others.
For 1954.
It's not terrible. I mean, I think
I've seen worse.
The full Godzilla suit looks pretty good. You know, the puppet that they use for, like, the upper body shots does not look that great. It depends really on the shot. There's a scene, like, where you see Tokyo burning and, like, in the distance, and then Godzilla kind of moving along the skyline, which looks really bad.
It's a little rough. Some of the matting on close-up shots of, like, his feet, like, stomping stuff, and there's, like, people running in front of his feet or behind his feet or something. Yeah. They look pretty bad.
Yeah, the matting shots where the people are in the foreground and Godzilla's kind of, like, way off in the background, I think, look really good. But when they try to do it, like, where they're trying to imply that they're really close together, yeah, it kind of...
Doesn't work.
It's kind of... You know, I think they did a pretty good job of hiding the wires. There's only a couple
Occasionally, you'll see some. Mostly, it has to do with, like, when they're moving his tail, you can see the wires.
The moving tail, yeah. Like, the scene where he's, like, you're looking through, like, a window of one of the buildings. You can clearly tell there's a wire on his tail. And then when the planes come, you can clearly see the wires that the planes are running along. To be fair, I don't think the creators of this movie were looking ahead 50 years and thinking, oh, yeah, this is going to be restored on high-def Blu-ray in 50 years. We better do better to hide these. But I doubt they would be as obvious, like, in the original. Like, if you were watching this in the theater in 1954, I doubt they'd be near as obvious. But overall, you know, and then his atomic breath is not that great in this first one. It's literally just, like, a spray mist of water that comes out of his mouth most of the time. Although, I think it does look really cool the way, like, the power line towers, like, heat up.
And melt.
That looks really cool. There are some really cool effects
in this movie, too. I think when his fins are, like, charging and they glow, they look a little rough.
The animation looks a little rough. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I was trying to think of some other major things.
I guess part of effects would be talking about the models.
The models,
The models are great. They're very well designed.
The miniatures are really good in this movie, I'd say.
Occasionally, obviously, you can tell, you're like, okay, yeah, that's a model or a miniature. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the buildings don't move. Like, when they're collapsing or, like, burning, I don't think they, like, move quite naturally like they would.
But overall, I mean, I think that the miniatures and the miniature sets, they look pretty dang good. I mean, they're extremely detailed, and it's highly impressive what they were able to do with these miniatures in 1954.
Yeah, definitely. So, I was definitely impressed. So, I guess the last thing really major we want to talk about is the score. This is the first score by Akira Ifukube we've heard. We heard some of his themes in King of the Monsters, but this is definitely not the last. He'll be back on this podcast. On this podcast. I love his score for this movie. The themes that he came up with for this movie are... I love the military march.
The military march is really cool. I like it a lot.
The Godzilla march, obviously, it will come back many times. It's really impressive. I think the tracks are called, like, Prayer for Peace, which is the one when the girls are singing, and then again, which is kind of the same kind of theme that Godzilla Beneath the Sea that we'll hear again when they're killing Godzilla at the end. Those tracks are, I don't think we hear them again in the entire Godzilla franchise, but those are really moving, really powerful pieces of music that I'm really impressed that Ifukube came up with, because usually his scores we'll find are really loud and bombastic, but those are really more subdued and emotional. But overall, I just love his score for this movie.
No, his score for this movie is really, really good. He composed some great themes for this movie. I mean, and they have stuck around till...
Did they?
65 years later, so...
I even like kind of the rough recording quality of them that you hear. Like, every once in a while, you can, like, hear the people setting down their drumsticks or whatever. But it's just kind of like the old movie charm they have.
Very staticky, and you can hear all that white noise. It sounds pretty great. I love hearing that white noise. I mean, I like listening to stuff on vinyl, so.
Yeah, I just love it all together, so.
I actually saw where they are releasing the King of the Monsters score on vinyl with a three LP set.
Mm-hmm.
So there's three separate, like, actual, like, discs or actual records,
mm-hmm.
and they're all different colors. Like, one of them's blue, one of them's yellow, and one of them's red.
That's pretty sweet.
And they're really cool looking. They're actually really, really cool looking.
That's pretty sweet.
I thought about getting it and putting it in here just so you could come listen to it every once in a while, just so you could, like, look at it and be like, oh, these are pretty.
These are pretty.
Mm-hmm. Nah. They're actually really, really pretty colored, and they kind of have, like, almost like a texture look to them. Kind of cool.
That is cool. So, I guess we can kind of get into final thoughts and everything. So, Dylan, why don't you give it, like, your final thoughts and a grade?
So, overall, for the time that this movie was made and what it is, I think it's really exceptional what they were able to create with this story and creating a human storyline and characters that you actually care about or are invested in, as well as incorporating Godzilla into that. So not only is this a movie about a giant monster, mm-hmm. you also have a movie about compelling characters that could probably stand on its own had you never even seen Godzilla show up in the movie, which is a great credit to the writers of this film. The suit design is a classic. It's absolutely great.
Mm-hmm.
Effects are, like we've said, hit or miss. I mean, there are some shots that are a little questionable for the most part. I mean, I think that they are completely passable for 1954. Sometimes I would say maybe even passable compared to some of today's standards, like the movie that we watched the other day. The score is absolutely exceptional. Akira Ifukube did an amazing job composing these original themes that live on today.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually really enjoy this movie the second time I've seen it. I'm going to give it an A.
And hey, all right, Andrew, final thoughts in a grade.
For what it is, I thought this movie had one of the best storylines in any other Godzilla movie. And the effects, they're not the best, but they're pretty cool for what they were. And with what it's worth, I think I'm going to give it an A-.
An A-. All right, so yeah, I mean, obviously this is one of my favorite movies ever made. I've already said that a couple of times. Like we've talked about, the human element of this movie is probably about as good as it's going to get as far as Godzilla movies goes. And that's really good. That's not a knock on it. I think it's really good. Effects, you know, some hold up better than others, but I'll forgive a lot of that. And just looking at its historical importance, the way it kicked off the kaiju genre in Japan, all the monster movies that it inspired after it, and then it's the really
and the 35 sequels.
Yeah, the 34 sequels so far. 34. 35 next year. The really powerful anti-nuclear message that it had behind it, and the way they really pulled that off really well. And then, of course, Akira Ifukube's score. I can listen to Akira Ifukube's work all day at work just on replay. We'll get to hear plenty of it watching these movies for this podcast. I just really love this movie. The minor flaws that we've talked about are not enough to prevent me from giving this movie an A+.
A happy moment.
An A+. Considering, I mean, especially putting it up against the other movies we're going to watch for this podcast. And I said when we started this podcast, I'm going to be comparing these not so much as it's like against all the films ever made, but really more just like against other Godzilla, other monster movies that we'll be watching for this podcast. Now, I still think this movie would be at least an A-, no matter what movie for me personally I'm comparing it against. But
compared to, like, say something like The Dark Knight, which is 100% an A+.
Yeah. But for the context of this podcast, I'm going to give this movie an A+. So, my first A+.
I'm just impressed that I gave it an A.
What?
I said, I'm just impressed I gave it an A.
I know. I'm glad you gave it an A. I'm glad you liked it that much that you gave it an A. So, I think that really concludes our conversation on this movie. Let's talk about our news. There's really two big news items I wanted to talk about. Number one, there was an interview with, I believe it was Warner Brothers CEO or Legendary CEO, somebody that said that there's a possibility that they're going to delay Godzilla vs. Kong because
they... Again?
What?
Again?
Well, they haven't delayed it yet.
I thought they were already delaying it.
Well, no, they were... It's still slated officially for a March release date. They haven't officially delayed it yet. But they may push it back to later in the year to give it time for reshoots and stuff. He says that he does recognize that there was some issues with Godzilla King of the Monsters, and they just really want to deliver an A+ movie. So they may push it back and give it some reshoots and stuff. This isn't the worst news in the world. I wish they could still make the March release date because I think that's the best. Like
at the latest, I would want them to push it back more than about a month. Late April is about as far back as you're going
to
go.
I really, if they're going to push it back, I'd rather them push it back to like the fall until after the summer season. I do not want them to release it in the summer season. I
think it won't make money.
I think that's really what killed this movie more, even more so than the bad writing, was the competition.
Coming out at the very end of May, I mean, it's a very saturated market during the summertime.
So I just wish that I just want them to pick up.
I could see them doing it like late fall, like maybe September, October, right around there. Or they either need to do it earlier in the year in the springtime, or they need to do it later in the year is probably the best option. If they're gonna push it back and release it earlier in the year at the latest, late April.
Yeah,
as far back as you're gonna be able to push it.
Because even late, like Endgame came out late April this year, so I mean, even late April, you're running into competition pretty quick.
And Endgame is still sitting at like number 7 at the box office.
Yeah, so you know, avoid the Marvel. The best advice I can give it: avoid the Marvel movies. Just avoid the Marvel movies at all costs.
Which I don't think there's a whole lot coming out next year.
Avoid any Disney movie because Disney movies will destroy you every
Disney
time.
Disney owns the market.
Aladdin. I don't think they thought that Aladdin would be the competition that it was this year, and Aladdin really killed Godzilla this year. Aladdin is still making money.
It's like number 3 at the
box. And that movie sucks. So Disney products are just hard to beat, and they just really need to avoid them. But, I mean, if they are going to legitimately do reshoots that they think will improve the movie,
hopefully this is a good movie.
I will say that I read something purporting to be like a condensed summary of the plot for Godzilla vs. Kong. I mean, there's probably like a 99% chance this isn't real. And I'm going to say I hope to God it's not. Because if it is, it sounds pretty terrible. Like, I mean, it's just basic. They don't mention the human characters at all. Which, I don't know how the movie... If this thing plays out like it reads, I don't know how they would have any time for the human characters, because it sounds like it is literally all monster fights. Just one monster fight after the other. Which, I mean, is cool, I guess, but, like, my issue with the last one was that the human characters were crap. I don't want them to be crap again, you know, so...
Or basically non-existent.
Non-existent. Maybe some reshoots they can help with that. But I really hope like the thing that I read is not accurate because it sounded pretty rough. But I won't say any details of it just in case it is real and it is actual spoilers. But the other big thing that they kind of announced with E3 and everything going on, a Godzilla card game.
What?
Yeah. I mean, I have a Godzilla card game in my room right now. It's basically... What? Yeah. The one I got, I think it's called Godzilla Stomp.
What?
It is basically like, what's the game? It's not Go Fish. The one where you like keep laying down, you lay down like cards at the same time and whoever has the bigger card wins.
War.
It's just war, but with Godzilla monsters.
Godzilla War.
This game, I don't even think they have an official title for it yet. Or maybe they're just going to call it Godzilla. I don't know. But from what I've read, it's going to be I'm not a big card game player. So, I'm sorry if I don't get some technicals right. It's going to be a deck-building game, which is similar to, like, collectible card games like Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh! Or whatever. But the difference is, instead of, like, buying randomized packs to build your deck, you just take all the cards that come with it and just build your deck throughout the course of the actual gameplay to try to have the best hand or whatever. It sounds like they're even going to do, like, tournaments for it and stuff. So, I mean, could be fun. I don't know. I'll buy it when it comes out. It's going to be kind of expensive. I think it's going to be like $50 or something.
That's ridiculous, Aaron.
I don't know. Could be fun. I think that's really all the news we had to cover. Next week, we are going to watch another film that came out in 1954. Came out a few months before the one we just watched. Them. Also had a little bit of influence on this movie. But yeah, Them! Exclamation point.
Them.
About giant ants.
Giant ants that act like a hydra, according to the case, where it says, kill one. Two more will take its place.
I'm excited to watch it again. Just like the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, I have only seen this movie once, and it was many years ago. So I'll be pretty
many
fresh.
Many years ago, like he's an old man.
Yeah, like I'm an old man. But it's probably been 8 or 10 years ago.
8 or 10 years, that's like half your life, no?
I'm pretty fresh coming into it, so really excited. It's an American monster movie. Dylan, you don't have to read subtitles.
I don't mind reading subtitles.
Andrew, you don't have to read subtitles.
I don't mind.
That's what he says.
Okay, that's what he's... Andrew does a good job reading subtitles. Me and him watch a lot of anime.
Watch a lot of anime. Freaking weebs.
But no, I'm really excited for it. But anyway, I think I'll probably close this out on, if I can find it on YouTube, the Godzilla Beneath the Sea track, because it's the only film that track is really used in, and so we won't get another opportunity to listen to it. But and I love it. So if you want to contact us, you can contact us at StompThisWay1954@gmail.com.
Yeah, and we are up on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We are at StompThisWay on all those platforms. So go ahead and give us a like or follow and tell your friends about it.
If you want to go to our website, you can go to www.stompthisway.podbean.com.
And I'm just going to say, sorry for all the Japanese names that we probably grossly mispronounced in this.
We're gonna be doing. I personally told Aaron that I did not want to do the cast and crew on this because I know for a 100% fact that I would have butchered them way harder than Aaron might have.
We're gonna
them.
Do that a lot of in this podcast, but I hope you'll stick with us. Again, join us next week for them. And as always, I'm Aaron.
I'm Andrew.
And I'm Dylan. And we'll see you next time.